In the good land of Lumia, fertile and green and machine, that the Lumians worked at for 200 years, building out of the boxes upon tiers of engines and widgets and motors and boilers, extensions and gear wheels and gaugers and coilers, and the awesome machine mounted up to the sky. No other machine ever mounted so high. For the Lumians, working by day and by night, thought the things it produced were a Lumi delight. And in order to buy them, the Lumians stopped at the Lumian Paymaster's pay money shop, where they got their Lusandas, the Lumian money, and ran to the Lumian store milk and honey. There, from hundreds of pipes, the production machine dispensed millions of things, from sublime to obscene. And the price of each thing in bright new Lusandas was worked out by the number of each thing demanders, and all costs that went into making each thing, like materials, labor, and new investing. Now we ask you to look at what happened one time when the gross national product was involved in a climb. For the Lumians had wants, and they thought they could make the production machine produce all they could take. They worked faster and harder and pulled in their brothers and even some sisters, some aunts, and some mothers. Wheels spun and stacks bubbled. There was all the enjoyment, the fruits of a land that was at full employment. And they all grabbed their payments in Lumian money and ran to get their share of more milk and honey. They pushed and they shoved in and out of the door, whether money or things, they were still wanting more. Now the clamor for more couldn't do any good. The production machine produced all that it could. It got so frenetic that for some strong demanders, the prices went up in Lumian Lusandas. And then the demanders, with things going up, were demanding more money to sweeten the cup. We want things, they shouted, and it's taking more money. We need it, and now, and it's not very funny. For as fast as they'd run to the heart of a store, those prices kept climbing. And still, they said, more. More money to buy the same number of things. So each thing cost more, and the prices took wings, flapping higher and higher, and wages did too, and the Lumians boiled in a terrible stew. The confusion was rampant, and this is the sleeper. The Lusanda was just getting cheaper and cheaper. And this stupid and reckless and wrong situation that can change and distort the whole shape of a nation is the thing that economists call and inflation.
The thing about inflation, or the threat of inflation, is that it distorts the economy. It doesn't necessarily mean a loss in product and income as a whole. It's a sad truth that for every loser, there's a winner.
A winner every game and a prize every time we go.
One economist said, inflation divides the people into sharpies and suckers. There's a premium on beating the game. Borrowers can pay back debts in cheapening dollars. Lenders try to protect themselves by raising interest rates, or they stop lending. School bonds, state and municipal bonds, even at high interest rates, soon find no takers. Money shrinks too fast. Savers become frustrated because they end up with less money in constant dollars than they put in. Old people and pensioners on fixed incomes take a licking. Their dollars buy less and less. Prices going up, imports from non-inflating countries pour into the market. Money to pay for them goes out of the United States, and the balance of payments can become horrendous. And as if increase of appetite grows by what it feeds on, prices and wages leapfrog each other to stay ahead of the dismal game. Whether you beat it or not, it makes almost everyone feel that he's being shortchanged, even cheated. It's disturbing, disruptive, divisive. If and when the brakes are applied, prices and wages may be stubborn and inflexible, still climbing, even while a slowdown can multiply itself and spread recession like a brush fire, from tight money to investment contraction. to unemployment with its vast quashing of demand and the penalties of social unrest and waste of resources. For a long time, alternating prosperity and recession were accepted as a way of life. That was called the business cycle. To halt it became the great cause of post-World War II economics. The Council of Economic Advisers was formed, and economists moved from class and consulting room up close to the centers of power. The tools were taxes, expenditures, money. Let's go back to Lumia for a moment. Now, actually, the Lumian people themselves are not the last of the big spenders. Their government, too, is a consumer on a large scale. Its purchasing agents buy defense material, office supplies, air traffic centers, all the things a government should supply. Its total spending is about 30% of the gross national product. Since the government is such a big spender, what and how it spends, meaning what its budget is, has an enormous effect on the economy. To pay its bills, the government collects taxes, taking a share of the Lusandas before they can get to the marketplace. Now, if the government taxes more than it spends, the result is a surplus. Since it is taking this money out of the income stream, spending fewer Lusandas than it's removing, there is less overall demand for things from the production machine, and production slows down. On the other hand, if the government's taxes are less than the budget, it is putting in more than it's taking out, thus raising demand and stimulating the economy. The government realized that it had a great device here for smoothing out the ups and downs of the business cycle, a budget policy that had automatic stabilizers built in. It works like this. You set the federal budget in a way that would give a moderate surplus if and when the economy is at high employment, really humming. Now look what happens. If the economy overheats, under a progressive tax system, many more tax dollars are being taken out of the income stream. This tends to cut down on total demand and cool things off a bit, like a safety valve. On the other hand, if things slow down too much, people will be making less money and the government will get less taxes. But in this case, the government is spending more than it takes out, spending at a deficit, which tends to push total demand up, thus stimulating the economy and avoiding a recession. Now that is how the use of taxes in the budget, which is to say fiscal policy, can be designed by government to stabilize the whole system. Those stabilizers are automatic, but they're not always enough. An automatic pilot does not take a plane through a storm or handle heavy traffic or emergencies. Tax rates and budgets can be and are changed to suit the situation. That sometimes becomes a political problem. Another way to guide a complicated economy is to manage the availability of money. Money is more than meets the eye. It is the cash in circulation, of course. It's also the amount of demand deposits in the banks, in checking accounts. Sometimes even savings and bonds. It is whatever can be spent. When a bank gets a new deposit of, let's say, $1,000, it has to keep about a sixth of that deposit on reserve with the Federal Reserve Bank. That's the law. It doesn't need to hold it all. There's enough money to work with going in and out every day. It can lend or invest the rest. When the money it lent or invested is deposited in another bank, that bank does the same thing. It puts one-sixth in the Federal Reserve and lends or invests the rest. It's a matter of arithmetic to show that a $1,000 deposit in a bank can create about $5,000 or $6,000 of spendable money down the line. Now the Fed, the Federal Reserve, watching reserve accounts and transactions on the computer, also looks at the whole economic picture. It can control the money supply mostly by open market operations. If the amount of money in general circulation is too big for what's actually going on, inflationary, if you will, because with all that money around, consumers will be bidding up prices, the Fed will just stop buying. Or it sells some enormous quantity of government securities, say $1 billion worth. What happens? The buyers pay the Fed through their banks, and the Fed takes the money from the bank's reserves. Now the reserves will be much lower than they should be. Banks have got to bring them up again, by law. To do that, those banks now call in loans and sell bonds and securities they hold. Large sums are exchanged by teletype and order. They tighten up on money. They lend less. Interest rates go up. And in the same way that money expands up to 5 or 6 times, it now contracts. If money is too tight, the Fed can do just the opposite. Buy securities.
Bob, hold you up at 10 million October 29s for cash. Let me have that firm.
Their money then goes into the banks, and credit is expanded. It lends money to banks, too, at some set discount rate. This influences credit throughout the economy. Theoretically, the country's money supply grows in relation to the growth in national product, or should, if all things were equal. They rarely are. To a certain extent, the function of economics and government until the 60s was firefighting. An inflationary blaze at Constitution and 21st, raise taxes, balance the budget. A little recession at 34th and 5th, spend on public works, lower tax collection. After a fashion, it worked. 4 recessions between World War II and 1960 did not destroy the country, nor did the periods of prosperity get out of hand. But at the beginning of the 60s, our production machine was growing at a rate far less than our potential. And unemployment in 1961 was close to 7%. The chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors was Walter Heller.
Our basic concern back there in 1961, that it was really high time to reset our sights, to focus on the gap between what we were producing and what we were capable of producing, a gap of $50 billion of production that was running to waste. And to get the U.S. economy moving again in President Kennedy's terms, called for measures that went against the grain of traditional U.S. thinking. It called, in the middle of a period when you had a substantial deficit in the budget, it called for stimulative measures, even a tax cut. Well, to most people, it seemed as though a tax cut in the face of a budget deficit would worsen the situation. You know, orthodox thinking would have said, well, that'll plunge us into a deeper deficit. But in fact, of course, a tax cut that would activate the economy, that would stimulate production and incentives and increase demand and put people back to work, would do just the opposite. It would generate so much new activity and so much new income and profits that the additional revenues would actually balance the budget. But it was pretty hard to convince President Kennedy of this at first, and I believe we didn't really convert him to the new economics until well into 1962.
The myth persists that federal deficits create inflation and budget surpluses prevent it. What we need is not labels and cliches, but more basic discussion of the sophisticated and technical questions involved in keeping a great economic machinery moving ahead.
Business listened suspiciously. It was probably no coincidence that the first enticement toward expansion was an investment tax credit. The next step was much bigger. The president asked Congress for a general tax cut in January 1963. But the tax machinery on Capitol Hill grinds slowly, carefully, and dubiously. This one didn't come until 1964. It worked. By the spring of 1965, the gap between actual and potential was closing fast. The Federal Reserve increased the money supply to accommodate the activity, going with the flow. Even with the tax cut, the expansion brought in high revenues, and the federal budget went into surplus in the first half of 65. We were heading for the promised land, peacetime full employment. But amidst the general euphoria was one big word of caution, inflation. The economic managers felt they had the tools to hold it at bay. Excise tax cuts actually tended to lower the over-the-counter selling prices, and the heavy business investments in plants and equipment would add to the power of the production machine and raise output to match demand. New manpower programs would, they hoped, help to open up labor bottlenecks where a shortage of labor could bid up wages considerably. Foreign competition was strong, and that would help keep a rein on prices. Then there was the use of the jawbone, using wage and price guidelines, and presidential pressure to coax business and labor to hold the line. Arthur Okun was then a member of the Council of Economic Advisers.
Well, as of mid-1965, prices were creeping up moderately at a rate of about 1.5% a year. Actually, unit labor costs were still declining. By any standard that I know, there was no reason, no cause for alarm about inflation. The big challenge, as we saw it, was could we manage a sustained, high-powered, full-employment economy? Could we find the right temperature of the economic boiler to generate a lot of steam and yet not overheat the boiler? The record looked good. The prospects were promising. We couldn't be sure, but we thought it was an exciting prospect, a great challenge. And unfortunately, we never got to realize that prospect, and I think never even got a fair test of that challenge.
Aggression will never prevail.
The military escalation threw all the plans off the track. Defense purchases rose suddenly by $3.33 billion in the last half of 1965, a whopping chunk of new demand. The boom had started. How do you finance a war under these high-pressure conditions? Cutting non-defense expenses isn't that easy. And is it right to put the whole burden of war on the cities and the poor? Tightening up the money supply is like a direct tax on home building and investment. Is that the lowest priority? Or do you raise taxes to mop up purchasing power? As it turned out, the president did not ask for a general tax increase. It was considered politically impossible. And it may have been. Nobody likes a killjoy. To make matters worse, military outlays for 1967 were underestimated by a looming $10 billion. The first burst of price and wage pressure showed up in raw materials and services. The rest followed soon enough. At capacity production, unit costs do go up. And there's little risk that if you raise prices, your competitors will pick up a share of your business. They're already producing all they can. What's more likely, they'll raise prices too. Soon everyone, everywhere, gets on board, lest conscience doth make cowards of us all. The Federal Reserve people looked at the overheated gauges and put a squeeze on money and credit. They loosened up again when housing starts plummeted, and the capital investment boom subsided in early 67. The economists watch the indicators now, ready to sound the alarm at the first signs of the jolly green giant reawakening. The signs came. Military estimates were being marked up again, money was looser, and housing rebounded. It was time to put fiscal policy on stream again, with a solid general tax increase, before another inflationary explosion. Well, economist proposes, Congress disposes. The answer was no. As for public opinion on a tax increase,
I'd be completely opposed to such a measure at the time.
I'm unhappy about it.
But I think it's bad.
For what?
Well, he
Pay tax now, prevent inflation later. Sounds to most people like the old con game. Give me your money and I'll make you rich. Through 68, the economy was really moving. Congress finally passed the 10% surcharge. The budget was chopped. The new president exerted his efforts.
Those who bet on inflation are going to lose their bet.
But sad to say, prices and wages kept going up. The fever was rife in the land. And this stupid and reckless and wrong situation that can change and distort the whole shape of a nation is the thing that economists call an inflation. To discuss some of the issues raised by expansionist tactics, inflation, and the risks of remedy, the Committee for Economic Development assembled a panel of eminent economists. Paul Volcker, Undersecretary of the Treasury for Monetary Affairs under President Nixon. Arthur Oaken, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Johnson. Henry Wallach, a member of President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisors. And Frank Schiff, Chief Economist with CED. These are excerpts.
Here's the richest economy in the world, and we say we're facing a capital shortage. We want to do a great many things at the same time that we can't all do. We have to set priorities in rebuilding cities and cleaning up the environment, improving schools, medical services. All these great demands that we're beginning to realize are pushing toward more expenditure.
Well, I think we'd all agree that we haven't found a way to have a tolerable compromise between prosperity and price stability, and that as long as that's the case, we're going to have some periods in which we have more inflation than we'd like and other periods in which we have a lot more unemployment than we'd like.
Is there anything one can do about the general trend of wages? Or prices apart from general fiscal and monetary policy measures?
I think there's pretty clear evidence on one thing that people shouldn't do, and that's lift the lid in a moment when one's trying to fight inflation. I think the U.S. experience suggests that we have paid a significant price for declaring open season, as it were, on wage and price decisions by the private sector. You know, on the face of it, it's really incredible that we've had a tide of protectionism on foreign trade policy developing at the very time that we're in this acute battle to get rid of inflation without taking a serious recession and depression in the process.
Very understandably why that should happen. The inflation raises prices, raises costs, and so producers become more vulnerable to foreign competition. They go and ask for protection. This is one of the prices you have to pay if you tolerate inflation.
But nonetheless, all the more the consumer has been protected by foreign competition just for that very reason in recent years. And we don't have anybody who comes down to Washington to lobby for the health of the overall economy. There is no, the overall economy is just too big to generate a powerful legislative force in its behalf. There are all groups with very special interests that have enough of a clear interest in particular policies to really press for them, and yet the general interest, which is widely shared by the overwhelming millions of American consumers, just never seems to get enough expression in the legislative process.
We know that in the Congress there's a big gap, for example, between the people who make decisions about expenditures and the ones who make those about look at revenues. There hasn't been very much coordination, I think. Some of the things that would make a tremendous difference if you could get a much quicker action in the Congress and much quicker action in many ways in the executive branch. Is there anything that can be done by businessmen, labor groups, the public generally, that can really help in this fight against inflation? Do you see anything in this area that could also be done?
I think the actions that the labor and business and consumers can take as citizens in recognizing the importance of prosperity with price stability and being willing to back their congressmen on measures that are essentially unpleasant and supposedly politically poisonous, like raising taxes, like recognizing that sometimes the tax increase is the only way to get insurance against higher interest rates and higher prices and worse public services, like recognizing the fact that we can't have unlimited increases in government spending for programs, no matter how good those programs look, unless we're willing to finance them and unless we're willing to wait for the growth of the economy to make these responsible.
I suppose in general, the lesson is that one's private interest doesn't always coincide with the national interest, and we rely primarily on the government to serve the national interest, but it does need the support of an enlightened citizenry. Maybe one sums it up by the old statement, there is no free lunch, and the citizenry has to recognize that.
Informed debate must go on, for the big questions remain. What kind of nation do we want? Which way do we move? How far? And at what cost? Whatever else the issues are, they are also economic. And having to make tough choices is part of the price all of us pay for a free society.